you know, if you're somebody who just does verification or just crunches numbers, you know, I don't think that it may not go to zero, but I don't think you're going to see substantial growth in the value of the product that you're producing over the next 10 years.
Hey gang, welcome to the celebrity edition of Future Proof. As always, I'm your host, Bill Sheridan. And hey, this is cool. This week's show is sponsored. Yes, we have a sponsor. Big milestone here at Future Proof. We're very excited. We are sponsored this week by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors, unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Now, as you know, we spend most of our time on this podcast talking about the accounting and finance profession, what the future looks like for those of us who work in this rarefied profession, helping others make sense of their finances, their futures, their numbers, for lack of a better term. But here's the thing. We're not the only ones struggling with this future stuff, right? I mean, the future is uncertain for everybody. It's not just the professions that are dealing with this stuff. Well-off and working class, unemployed and entrepreneurial, engaged and disengaged. I mean, everybody is struggling with how to make sense of this changing and complex world. Things have never been more uncertain than they are today. Change will never move more slowly than it's happening today. You want to blow your mind? Think about that for a minute. I mean, change is happening at a mind-bending pace, and it's only going to speed up going forward. So if you're not keeping up today, your odds of keeping up tomorrow are slim to none, really. And you're not alone. Like I said, this is a worldwide thing. People everywhere are dealing, or more to the point, trying to deal with this stuff. So I guess the question is, what do we do about it? And few people have a better perspective on all of this than our celebrity guest this week. He is Alec Ross, author of the New York Times bestselling book, Industries of the Future, one of this nation's leading experts on innovation. He served for 4 years as senior advisor for innovation for Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. And he is currently a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University, who serves as an advisor to investors and corporations and government leaders. He lives in Baltimore, which is one of my favorite things about him. But here's the thing. He's traveled the world in search of what sets innovative thought leaders apart from the rest of us. And he has some very specific ideas about what we need to be doing and thinking about going forward in order to give us a competitive advantage over everyone else out there. And we'll talk about all that here in a second. First, here's what caught my eye this week. It's a great example of the speed at which things are changing these days. I saw this in Technology This Week, which is a terrific weekly newsletter curated by tech expert and CPA, Rick Richardson, who's been a guest on the show as well. But in this week's newsletter, Rick pointed to a list of 10 jobs that didn't exist just a dozen years ago in 2006. 10 jobs that we kind of take for granted now, but that were not around just 12 years ago. Here you go. Number one, app developer. Number two, social media manager. Number three, Uber driver. Number four, driverless car engineer. Number five, cloud computing specialist, right? Number six, data analyst or data scientist. Number seven, sustainability manager. Number eight, YouTube content creator. Number nine, drone operator. And number 10, millennial generation expert. There seem to be an awful lot of those around, aren't there? And you can almost add podcast host to that list. I think the first podcasts were launched in 04 or thereabouts. So there you go. In fact, a recent report out of the UK estimates that 2/3 of today's children will end up taking jobs that do not exist today, which sounds crazy, right? But when you think about it, it's really not. Here's another article in Richardson's newsletter. It's an interview with Jonathan Reichenthal, who is the CIO of the city of Palo Alto, California. Here's what he says, and I'm going to quote him directly so I don't screw anything up here. He says, quote, "The continuing automation of society means human beings have increasingly focused on higher level work. Going back 100 years, and a huge proportion of our society is either working on a farm or working in a factory. Hardly anyone works on farms anymore. We have machines that do the work that humans used to do. Our factories are massively automated with mass production technologies. So as we've moved through the first industrial revolution all the way into this fourth industrial revolution and the information economy, the skills people require are different. End quote. So all the stuff that's happening today, it's all happened before. It's just happening way faster now. And I think the reason we feel so crazed and stressed about things these days is that we're right in the middle of that shift right now, right? We're just beginning to understand that the skills we have to have in order to remain relevant are changing. We're just beginning to accept that notion that we have to unlearn and then relearn what we know. And we haven't gotten there yet. In fact, we may not ever completely get there because of the pace of change. As soon as we learn today's skills, we're going to have to unlearn those and learn a whole new set of skills. So really our jobs going forward, everybody's job is professional student, constant learner, whatever you want to call it. We've got to get comfortable with being flexible. And that brings me back to my guest this week, Alec Ross, because being flexible isn't a comfortable thing for a lot of people in a lot of professions, accounting and finance included. But those who make that transition, whether we're talking about CPAs or entire professions or entire nations, the ones that make that transition will be best suited to successfully navigate all of the changes that we're dealing with today and the ones we'll be dealing with tomorrow. So Alec and I talked about all of that as well as this profession in particular. He offered his views on the roles that accounting and finance pros will play going forward, what they need to do now to prepare. And we ended the conversation on kind of an interesting note, how we should be thinking of guiding our children's choices of what to study and what careers to focus on. That's not an easy thing to do these days when they'll likely be working in a career that doesn't currently exist. So he had some interesting thoughts on all of that as well. This was a really fun interview to do with a very deep and intelligent thinker and just a great down-to-earth guy. I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. Here is Alec Ross.
So Alec, your book came out in 2016, which doesn't sound like a long time ago, but in a world that's changing as quickly as ours is, it seems like a lifetime. So I guess my first question is, if you were writing it today, what would be different? What would be in there that isn't right now?
Well, you know, it's funny. The Industries of the Future did come out 2 years ago in 2016. But I wouldn't change a word. Yeah. In fact, if anything, I was a little early in some of the content, and a lot of that is now bearing out. And in fact, even though it came out in English in the United States 2 years ago, it's actually coming out in a half dozen more languages this year. It'll be in 24 languages by the end of 2018. I guess if I were to add one thing, it is on virtual reality and augmented reality. And the combination of that with artificial intelligence, I think a lot of people think about virtual reality and augmented reality as being, rooted in fantasy or, you know, plan your own adventure type stuff. But where I see companies investing research and development dollars is combining bots, like chat bots, mm-hmm. with virtual reality, so that interestingly, you know, people can be going through a session with, say, a financial planner in an almost choose your own adventure way, incorporating augmented reality, virtual reality components. So that's I guess one thing I would add to it.
That's really interesting. And another thing that I kind of zeroed in on as I was reading the book was this notion of globalization, which plays a major role in the book. And the general sentiment at the time was that role would continue to expand and grow. And I guess, and of course, a lot has kind of changed in the last couple of years in that time, in that reference. So I guess my question is, in a world of things like, you know, Brexit and Donald Trump and notions of, you know, increased nationalization and things like that, is that changing? Is globalization, you think it's contracting at all? Or I mean,
not at all. No, it's interesting. You got to just look at the math. So it's interesting. I think first, the principal political and economic binary of the 20th century was left versus right, the political left versus the political right. I think that the binary that better describes today's political landscape is not left versus right so much as open versus closed.
Okay.
And so what we've seen is certain markets like the UK with Brexit, certain markets like the US with Donald Trump taking on more mercantilist economic policies and stricter immigration policies. And so even though in some developed countries, there seems to be this pushback against globalization, what it's not doing is slowing capital flows or labor flows. If anything, what it means, for example, if we're going to be more restrictive about immigration in the United States, or if the UK is going to be more restrictive about immigration, what it means is that instead of there being a heavy concentration of innovation and wealth creation in places like California or Boston, where these high-tech companies are, they'll be elsewhere. You know, instead of immigrants working at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, they will stay in Bangalore, where they will imagine and invent the future. So there is a political impulse pushing back against globalization. But if you actually look at how the money is flowing and where the people are flowing, it continues to move apace, just not necessarily as much into the US or to the UK.
Interesting. So from the standpoint of this profession in particular, the world keeps getting, well, for the sake of our conversation, bigger, right? We're not closing down. We're still opening up.
No, that's right. And look, you know, it's interesting to me to see some of the demographic differences on this. It tends to be people 45 and older who are providing most of the pushback to globalization, whereas the culture for Gen X and younger, particularly with the millennials, it's much more open. And if you look at the Brexit vote in the UK, if you look at who's in favor and against both more mercantilist trade policies in the US and more restrictive immigration policies, it actually breaks down fairly remarkably along age lines, even more so than it does around traditional political party lines.
That's very interesting. So something to look forward to there. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about blockchain for a couple of minutes. So you spent some time in the book discussing that, and it was still fairly new and kind of unknown in 2016, and now it's certainly, it's like at the top of the hype cycle at this point. But
that's right.
This notion of a transparent, kind of distributed, decentralized ledger, I think has a lot of people in our profession, especially, watching it very carefully. You know, the promise of, you know, decentralized verification starts to edge into the world of audit and attest. And in fact, an accounting professor at NYU said recently, he thinks audit will essentially be dead in 10 years because of technologies like this. And I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a little far-fetched. You know, audit is not going to go to zero in 10 years. But what I do think is that blockchain will enable the digitization of trust in a way in which historically and in the past we've relied on humans to verify trust in a very centralized, bluntly very expensive manner. And it's already happening. You know, this is not a hypothetical based on a theoretical based on a maybe. You know, Goldman Sachs, for example, with its major banking partners in China, it's not a public blockchain, but what they have is they do asset settlements within their own sort of walled garden among trusted banking partners for asset settlements. And it saves them hundreds of millions of dollars a year in asset settlement costs on both sides of the transaction. But I think it's important to back up. I think a lot of the more utopian views of blockchain have a fundamental misunderstanding of what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, what blockchain is an advancement in computer science. It's like HTML. In the same way in which HTML enabled the internet to be this sort of geeky two-dimensional thing only used by engineers in the 80s and early 90s, HTML created what we came to call the World Wide Web. It made the internet something that the general public could navigate, find accessible, visual. Similarly, what blockchain is, it's like HTML. It's foundational technology, which will enable us to do transactions digitally that previously we would not have trusted digital to do. You need five nines of trust, you know, 99.999% of trust to do a lot of really complex financial transactions. And what blockchain will do will enable that. So I do think that there, within the audit and accounting professions, I do think that blockchain and other technologies, including, you know, those rooted in AI, will supplant a lot of labor, but much of it obviously will exist because there's certain things that you can't or simply wouldn't want to hand over entirely to the machines.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting that you brought up that word trust, with blockchain becoming kind of this you know, champion of trust going forward. And of course, you know, the CPA's kind of tagline for years now has been, you know, we are that trusted business advisor. So with you know, new technologies kind of moving into that, what do you see accounting and auditors' role as being going forward? You know, when a lot of this foundational work, this kind of numbers crunching, if you will, is being automated away, what's our role going forward going to be looking like?
You know, it's really going to be, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the quantitative skills that enable one to rise in, you know, in audit and accounting are going to increasingly get turned over to the machines. And what's interesting is that which makes us most human is going to grow in importance over the next 5 to 10 years. So if you are an accounting professional, if you're an audit professional, you know, it's not a good bet to bet that you're going to be able to crunch the numbers more effectively than software. What is a good bet is that you will be able to listen to your customer, understand what his and her real goals are, understand how to mitigate risk for them, understand sort of the risk profiles that they're willing to get into. So it's really, you're almost going to see the communications part of the audit and accounting profession grow more important than ever. And, you know, if you're somebody who just does verification or just crunches numbers, you know, I don't think that it may not go to zero, but I don't think you're going to see substantial growth in the value of the product that you're producing over the next 10 years.
Interesting. So maybe some new skill sets that we're going to have to be learning going forward rather than relying on the same old stuff.
No, it's right. I mean, you wouldn't have normally have thought of audit and accounting as professions that required emotional intelligence.
Right.
But I really think you do now. And what's interesting too, let's talk about age again. I'm 46 years old and, you know, I have a wealth advisor and an accountant who I like getting on the phone with and talking through things with. The 26-year-olds who work for me find that anachronistic. And so the 26 year olds have very different levels of comfort than the 46, 56, and certainly the 66 year olds about who and what they want to interface with. They would rather discuss things, you know, by typing it and by texting it than by having an in-person conversation. So part of this is, you know, as those 26 year olds become 36 year olds and homeowners, as those 36 year olds become 46 year olds and go from, you know, having a net debt household financial profile to a net asset profile, you know, understanding how to communicate with them and having some emotional intelligence is going to be really important.
Yeah. And again, it sounds like I'm switching gears here, but I think all of this kind of ties in together. One of the stories that I love from your book, and one that I think has implications for what we're trying to do as a profession, is the Estonia story. So for those who are listening who don't know that, tell if you can boil it down to a Reader's Digest version, but tell that story for me. What's happening in Estonia that we should be paying attention to?
Sure, so it's fascinating. So after the fall of communism, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, suddenly went from being one country to 14 countries. And what that effectively meant was that there were 14 choices to be made about what political and economic model you were going to have. And Estonia, out of all the 14, chose the most sort of digital forward and the most open. And so what's fascinating is even though there were breadlines in Estonia in the early 90s, and people were sort of offering them development assistance, what they decided to do was literally leapfrog an entire generation of development and say, hey, even though we're this poor Baltic country, you know, emerging out of communism, we are not going to try to transition at all, you know, into the 1990s. We're going to try to springboard straight into the 21st century. And so all of their voting is electronic. All of their electronic medical records are electronic. You know, you pay taxes literally in real time as you earn your money. So there isn't an April 15th. There isn't a tax day. It's all done electronically, seamlessly, in real time, with very sophisticated encryption. And so it's interesting. It's almost like, it sounds pejorative, but I don't mean it to. It's almost this little digital Smurf village. You know, this little country of a couple million people in the Baltics living this fascinating life where this is what enabled them, of the 14 former Soviet republics, to today become the wealthiest. And it's where companies like Skype were born. It is a place where they are imagining and inventing the future and decided to go in sort of all in on the future and not take an incrementalist approach. And it worked for them.
It sounds almost like the moonshot, right? It's like we decided to do it and we went and did it. And it's almost the same thing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. After the fall of communism, all of the older leaders in the country were tied to Moscow. They were tied to the government in Russia. And so they were sort of wiped out with the fall of communism. So it was really this group of 30-somethings, you know, it's young, well-educated people, but still young, but with no loyalty to the past, in part because the economy was terrible. And they did make a moonshot on what their economic model was going to be and what their model for governance was going to be.
So thinking back to that story, is future growth and relevance going forward as much about mindset as anything, do you think?
It really is. I mean, look, H.G. Wells wrote 100 years ago, "Adapt or perish, 'twas ever thus." You know, I mean, look, the United States we're only about 4% of the global population. I mean, the U.S. is the most powerful and wealthiest of the world's 196 countries for a reason. It's because, you know, our economic model dating back to, you know, the founding of our country was rooted in entrepreneurship and innovation. And, you know, there have been many other great economic powers over the course of that time, Spain, England, France, others. And a lot of the time they foundered because they got stuck in their history. They got stuck in the moment. So the special sauce, you know, what makes America, America, is that this is a place where we constantly innovate, where we imagine and invent the future from the cotton gin to the web browser and everything in between. And as soon as we stop innovating, we're in big trouble because the cost of labor will always be lower in markets like India or China. And bluntly, we aren't the best educated country in the world. There are other countries out there with, on a per capita basis, substantially better educated citizens. And so our secret sauce has always been, you know, the very act of coming to America. It's in our DNA. It's an act of entrepreneurship. It's an act of innovation. It's very future focused. And so if we ever slow that down, we will see a slowing down in our economic power and in our geopolitical power.
Mm-hmm. So my final question comes from the father in me, and you spend some time talking about this toward the end of your book. We've got a daughter who's a high school junior. We're doing college visits now and have no real idea of like what kind of advice I should be offering her in terms of, you know, where should she be spending her time studying, you know, it frightens me a little bit how quickly things are moving. And so I guess just based on what you've seen and the trends that you've been following, what advice would you give a youngster who's just getting ready to start serious college studies? Where should they focus on? Or does it matter? I mean, will whatever they end up studying be obsolete in 4 years?
Well, look, it does matter what you study. I mean, if you go into your local Starbucks, you're quite likely to, you know, have your cappuccino made by somebody with a master's in comparative literature. you know, so these choices do matter. Mm-hmm. Now, the opposite extreme of, you know, the degree in comparative literature is the STEM degree, you know, in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And while I do believe that in education, a strong academic foundation in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics will likely ensure sort of a middle-class life, it's also the case that, number one, not everybody is built to do that. And number two, what if you don't want to just make it? What if you actually want to lead? And in this case, you know, my strong advice is to really focus on interdisciplinary learning. I think there is value and virtue in people having a technical expertise, whether that technical expertise is accounting, whether it's computer science, whether it's engineering, but it's the combination of aptitudes in fields that are technical with skills that we associate with the humanities, good communication skills, emotional intelligence, critical judgment. It's the coming together of the technical with the non-technical that I really think is going to create tomorrow's leader. And again, this isn't a hypothetical based on a theoretical based on a maybe. You know, let's talk about Facebook just by way of illustration. Everybody thinks of Facebook as this company that was founded by a computer science student, Mark Zuckerberg. What people don't know is that Zuckerberg was actually a dual major. Mm-hmm. He was a computer science major, but he was also a psychology major. And Facebook was as much a byproduct of Mark Zuckerberg's study of psychology as it was his study of computer science. And then I'll make two more points on this. I mean, first, to go to the earlier part of our conversation, Bill, we do live in a more global world. And in this more global world, the more good old-fashioned ink stamps you have in your passport, the greater a willingness you have to work across cultures, to work across countries, that really positions you well. It is sometimes the case, but not always the case, that you can sort of make your living within a little 10 square mile area. You know, increasingly, young people need to be global players. And then the last point that I would make is embrace mobility. I mean, the idea that you graduate from college at 22 and you are effectively going to have that same job with the same skills you walked off campus with at 22 at 62,
right?
You know, it just doesn't work anymore. You know, everybody has to be a lifelong learner. Mm-hmm. You know, you're more likely to have 20 jobs in 20 years than you are to have one job in 20 years. It's the world we live in. And so mobility, openness, lifelong learning, I think are going to be indispensable for today's students and for people newly entering the work world.
Yeah, great advice. So what are you working on now? What's the next project for you?
A big focus for me right now is on startups. I've got 7 startups that I work with really intensively to help them grow. They tend bluntly to oftentimes be very young, technically oriented founders, people who don't necessarily have a lot of stamps in their passport. So they're sort of genius engineers, but don't necessarily have a lot of depth of experience as executives. And so I have equity in these companies. I try to mentor the CEOs and help them grow. Mm-hmm. And I'm also really focused on, you know, my next book and thinking, all right, well, look, the industries of the future, it's in 24 languages now and reached a global audience because it helped unpack the next 10 years for people, principally through the lens of economics. You know, what are the big changes economically going to be? What do they mean for me, my family, my community, my city, my country? I'm really interested now in exploring the topic of what do all these changes, these technological and scientific changes, what are they going to have on me as a human, on my humanity? Mm. How I live differently, how I love differently, how I communicate differently. So one of the things that I've seen more and more is that for both good and bad, the technology is altering the relationships between people in their communities. And I want to explore that with some depth.
Already can't wait to read it. Alec Ross, thanks for taking the time and for your insights today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Alec Ross, author of the best-selling book, The Industries of the Future, a former senior advisor for innovation to the Secretary of State, and a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University, who also serves as an advisor to investors and corporations and government leaders. You can learn more about him at alecross.com. That's alecross.com. Special thanks once again to this week's sponsor, the Business Learning Institute. Visit them at blionline.org. And I will see you next week. Happy holidays, everybody.